The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with SuperValue Travel Insurance. Don't worry about a thing with Great Value Travel Insurance online at supervalue.ie.
Last year, I interviewed the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson. I began by asking him about his mental health and whether he still heard voices.
Oh, not as many voices I used to know. They've gone away quite a bit now.
And is that because of therapy or medication or...?
It's a little of each. It's mostly my own doing. I'm getting used to the voices in my head.
And is it a daily struggle with the voices in your head?
Not really. Once or twice a week now. It used to be every day.
In terms of day-to-day and what you do now, do you have a mantra? Do you say, like, we shall overcome, and that's how you get through the day with some exercise as well?
Well, my day starts with breakfast. Then I go to the park and work out for an hour, come back home, go to the piano, see if I can write something, then go back to the park again. I go to the park four times a day, and my legs are strong and I'm staying in good shape.
And the reason we're playing that clip this morning is because of this. The opening bars of a great pop song. Take a listen for a few seconds.
Always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be.
That's God Only Knows, a 60s classic from the Beach Boys, a 60s classic from Brian Wilson. That's Brian Wilson, the extraordinarily gifted composer and producer, and generally regarded by most people in the know as one of America's most gifted songwriters, and a bit of a genius, even if that's a word that's bandied around a little bit too loosely these days. Anyhow, there's a widely praised movie on release at the moment called Love and Mercy, a film which concentrates on a couple of mid-60s years and then a couple of mid-80s years in the life of Brian Wilson. In the mid-60s, played brilliantly by Paul Dano, Brian is trying to sort of back away from the surf, sea and summer holidays kind of sound of early Beach Boys to break out into something a bit more experimental and psychedelic. For the 80s, played by John Cusack, he's lost, being looked after by, indeed manipulated by, a self-serving, controlling psychotherapist and one of the best-known, kind of most infamous non-music names for those who know their history of the golden age of rock and roll. He is Dr. Eugene Landy. So now I want to talk about the film, I want to talk about Brian Wilson, and I want to talk about Eugene Landy. And sitting across from me is a doctor of Chinese medicine. And here's the really weird bit, my sister-in-law. That's right, my fabulous wife has one sister, and Deirdre Courtney is that fabulous sister. Welcome to the programme, Deirdre.
Hi, Dave.
All right, this is a bit weird, but let's talk about the real deal here. Okay. First of all, you've seen the movie, which is Love and Mercy.
Yep.
And I remember, like, we were sitting there watching it, and at one stage he buys this car near the beginning, and you knew exactly what was going on. You knew who she was and that. Did you know most of the movie in terms of the John Cusack side of things? Because John Cusack was the time that you were there.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first saw it, it kind of brought me right back to that time. I thought John Cusack had a lot of his mannerisms that were very good. But yeah, that whole time, I remember when he bought the Cadillac and came home and talked about the girl.
Right, okay. And the girl, of course, is the girl Melinda. He eventually married.
Yeah.
He finally married her in 95. Took a long time.
Yeah.
But anyway, so much had happened. So, like, you were plotting in California at the time. Why were you in LA and what were you doing? And did you see an ad in the paper saying, like,
no,
you know?
I went out to visit people and I got offered the job. Eugene Landy flew me out from Florida.
Oh, you were over in Florida.
Yeah.
Oh, I get you, right. Okay, and how did you get offered the job, though?
I had somebody who was doing the job had an accident and they asked me to take over for a few days when I was visiting.
Oh.
And in order for me to do that, Eugene had to interview me. But when he interviewed me, he then offered me the job and I basically said no, I'm not taking somebody else's job, and I finished my holiday.
Yeah.
And went back. But then a few months later he got in touch, tracked me down.
All right, okay.
And brought me out.
Okay, and like, what was the interview like? I presume obviously you knew who you were going to be working for. But what was the interview like?
The interview was quite weird. He was a very weird man. he was always trying to impress, and his whole thing was to try and see what it was that he could catch you on or get you on. So he wanted to know psychologically what you were like. In hindsight now, when I look back, when I was working there, it was all things he would use against you then to manipulate you in different situations. So it was kind of a control thing. But he'd ask you things like, he'd want to know, did you do drugs? And, you know, what kind of social life you'd have and stuff like that. And you felt like, you know, the cooler you were and the more you said you did these things, the more you might get the job. It was kind of weird.
But also the more he might be able to, it might come back to bite you.
Yeah, so I was very cautious. I said very little.
Right, okay, you said very little.
Yeah.
So what were you being employed for? Like, what was the job?
Well, the job was basically to be his chef.
To
Brian Wilson's chef.
Oh, right.
And so the idea was he was rehabilitating from being overweight and from all his drug and alcohol abuse. And so I was to cook healthy, you know, low sugar, low fat foods for him. But actually you ended up running the house, organizing their trips when they went away, you know, trying to help, you know, find what clothes he was going to wear on stage. You know, it went further. When he started recording, then I would bring food into the recording studio. I would go on holidays and cater for whoever else was coming with us.
Yeah. Because, like, we're talking kind of a little bit past the mid-80s, a little bit later than that. But just before all that, I mean, like, he was in a terrible state. I remember reading articles in Rolling Stone about the fact that, you know, he was 340 pounds, he was 6 packets of cigarettes a day, 5 yards and 5 grams of coke, etc. And he would bathe maybe once a month kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he was a total and absolute mess.
He was.
And, like, okay, so what kind of a mess was he when you saw him, or was he still?
He had lost a lot of weight and he was very fit. But he had a lack of control. So I remember the first thing that I was given when I arrived was a key for the fridge. Had this big lock and chain around it, because the whole thing was, well, what Eugene told me was that if Brian was to go to get a snack out of the fridge, he'd eat the whole fridge. Like, that control of, you know, knowing when he was full or when to stop. He didn't really have that. But he was like a child. He was like a child in an adult's body, you know.
So, like, if I say things like that he had, you know, like, I don't know, like drug-assisted psychosis and neuroses and all these kind of things. Like, you know, obviously we know that Landy tried to make it out to be much worse than it was, necessarily for his own ends, etc. In the movie, Paul Giamatti plays him and he's completely, like, psychotic. I mean, Paul Giamatti plays Landy.
Yeah.
He's completely mad. He's crazy. He shouts and screams and he's mad. Very manipulative. I get the impression from you that the first bit's not right. He didn't shout and scream, but the second bit's completely right.
Yeah, he was really manipulative and he was a very controlled person. So he would humiliate you, but in a very quiet, controlled way. He would never shout and scream at you, but he would certainly make you embarrassed about. He would have made Brian embarrassed about eating the hamburger, but not by shouting at him, by humiliating him in some way to say, it looks very gross and what do you think Belinda's going to think of you stuffing your... You know, he'd do it in a different way. But I never saw Eugene lose his temper in that way.
As he did
all.
In the movie?
No.
Yeah, right. That was just a bit of poetic license, I suppose.
And
yeah.
I suppose it was a way of kind of really understanding how he, you know, trying to get it across how controlled and manipulative he was. I mean, he recorded every phone call that Brian ever made or received. Anybody that worked for me, you were required to report back everything that was said and done, which, you know, I was selective about that because it took Brian a long time to trust me as a person working in his home, you know?
Mm.
And once he started to trust me, then, you know, he would talk a little more about when he was younger and growing up with his father and stuff like that.
And when he was younger growing up with his father, I mean, I know that you don't want to go into details, but the details are horrific. They're much more than just an abusive father.
Yeah, I think some of
humiliating,
the stuff...
Humiliating, etc.
Yeah. I think some of the stuff that Brian told me would be stuff that he would never have kind of put out in public knowledge. So it would be nothing you'd see written in a book or hear.
Yeah.
What he told me was just unbelievable. You just wouldn't, you know...
There is a...
father was cruel.
Yeah, there is a biography of an autobiography of Brian Wilson. It's called Wouldn't It Be Nice. Now, Brian has said that he doesn't really remember writing too much of that, and that Landy might have written a lot of it, because Landy comes out of the book quite well. And there's another one coming out soon called I Am Brian Wilson. And in that one, Paul McCartney and Paul Simon and David Crosby, Bob Dylan, Lindsay Buckingham, they're all in that too. And it's much more of a kind of a fuller picture helping Brian write his book. But I mean, with the book, like, you get a nice mention actually in the other book, but I mean, Landy liked you, did he?
Yeah, Landy liked me. I think he liked me because I kind of didn't buy into the whole, you know, Hollywood, you know, music industry thing. Like, everybody would go to the gigs, you'd have all the laminates, but you'd be required to go in the limousine. I always went in my little bashed up Toyota. Mm. I tried never to buy into I'm famous because I work for somebody famous, because that was part of his ammunition. He'd make you have all this wonderful life, but he controlled it then. So if you didn't buy into that, he didn't have that control. So he kind of liked me because I was a little brazen. I suppose that's that Irishness in us, you know. We kind of not going. So yeah, and he liked my sense of humour, you know.
Who was in the house? There was Landy, there was Brian Wilson, there was yourself.
And there was a guy called Kevin. He was kind of like his bodyguard, companion. He also went swimming with him, jogging, did that whole thing. So it was just the three of us living in the house in Malibu.
And this is in Malibu. Now, there was another house in Bel Air, wasn't there?
No, well, I never knew the house in Bel Air. There was a house down the road in a nicer part of Malibu and a nicer house that Eugene lived in. And I subsequently heard that it's possible that Brian also owned that house. I'm not sure.
I would have thought Brian owned everything except, what do you call it? Eugene Landy had his will revised, and throughout the time you were there, anything that would have been left to Eugene Landy.
Yeah.
Now, it was changed again, and it was seen that Landy was the beneficiary of everything in 1991, and then that all fell apart after that. But I mean, like, there was court cases and everything else that happened.
Yeah.
Well, Eugene passed away some years ago, and like, you could easily look at the way Eugene did his thing with Brian Wilson and say that he was a self-serving quack, which he was. But let's take a look at something else. Did he help Brian?
Yes, absolutely. In my experience of being there, I could see the manipulation and I could see the advantage that Eugene was benefiting from this. But he also really got Brian together. He got him back into the studio. He got him back writing music. You know what I mean? He got him healthy again. Now, he went a little bit too far then, but really, Brian was a mess, and I don't see anybody could have got him together.
Well, I was just going to say, could somebody
radical.
Have got him together who wasn't so crazy?
No, I think he needed total radical.
I mean, he was a control freak. He was a kind of an odd psychotherapist in some ways. And he was 9 years with Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
And he really knew how to manipulate Brian as well. But having said that, you're saying that, like, you know, it wasn't necessarily paranoid schizophrenia that Brian had, even though he was enveloped in all this kind of madness for 15 years.
He was on a lot of medication.
Was he on too much medication because of Landy?
I would say so. And, you know, one of the things that at one point when I was working there, Eugene gave me a list of medication and kind of said, you know, this is what Brian's taking and I'll ring you and tell you what to give him when not. And I just gave him, I just said no. Like, I'm a chef.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not there to, I'm not a nurse. And so I refused. And I think that was also, you know, Brian kept, I had a certain type of relationship with Eugene because I didn't accept everything he asked me to do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I said no.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Okay, I'll tell you what, I want to take it for those not who weren't there or didn't know, even though it was the sound of summer, as in they invented California rock and song, celebrating kind of an idealised Californian teenhood, if you like, surfing and driving and dating. It still is the sound often of the summer in California in particular. Let's just take a little short blast of what we're talking about here, Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys.
Hoist up the John B. Sail. See how the mainsail sets. Call for the captain ashore. Let me go home. Let me go home. I wish they all could be in California. I wish they all could be in California. I wish they all could be California. Good.
Round, round, get around.
I get around.
Yeah,
get around, round, round.
I get around.
blast and goes cruising just as fast as she can now. And she'll have fun, fun, fun till her daddy takes the T-bird away.
There you go. That's just a short blast of the early part of what it all was in terms of the Beach Boys. Let's like to take a look at the Beach Boys themselves. We're talking to Deirdre Courtney here, my sister-in-law, who was with Brian for a bunch of years in the later years. If you see the movie, it's Paul Dano who plays him 65, 66, and it's John Cusack who plays him 85, 86 direction. The whole idea of him making the music with his band, you see it in the movie where he's going to go on tour to Japan, doesn't want to go on tour. He wants to stay behind and be a kind of a George Martin to the Beatles kind of thing in the studio and not go on tour. So they go on tour, he does his stuff in the studio, and that's the best bit of the movie. I mean, it's brilliant, sort of the creative sort of like, we can't do this, we can't do that, and yet, you know, Brian says, just do it and you'll see it'll work. And then it resulted, in fact I'll play it now, it resulted in this.
I love the colourful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. On the wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
There you go. That was one of the great sounds of the 1960s, and that is, of course, Good Vibrations from the Beach Boys. So all that creative kind of stuff, did you think that Brian always had something? He wants to get this thing out of his mind. Did he go around recording stuff all the time? Did you make sure he had a tape recorder with him?
Yeah, and he had had a piano room, a studio just at the back in the courtyard at the back of the house. And he spent a lot of time in there and everything was recorded. And he'd just go in and start banging away, and sometimes on the piano, and sometimes he'd come in and he'll hum something to you. I remember, like, as I'm making lunch, he'd hum something. And then he'd give some words and he'd say, you know, I need something to go with that. And then we'd all start coming up with words that, you know, what he should put. And then he'd run back to the piano. He always had something going on his head. It was really interesting for me because I worked for him for quite a while before he went into the studio to start recording.
Yeah.
And for me, I was dealing with a child almost. You know what I mean? Brian, have you brushed your teeth? Brian, you know.
Yeah.
And then I remember the first day going into the studio with the food, and I couldn't believe this was the same person, because he had this whole bunch of musicians and backing singers, and he was in total control.
Yeah,
he was in that space and he knew exactly what he wanted everybody to do, and he knew exactly how to direct everybody.
Right.
And it was completely different from what I'd experienced.
Yes, this is Brian, the producer in the studio with amazing ideas in his head, and this is why people call him a genius and all the rest now.
Yeah.
The thing, his relationship with the Beach Boys. The Beach Boys were an odd bunch. Now, Dennis had already died.
Yeah, and that was very tragic. Brian never got over that.
Yeah, he says that in the movie
never
as well.
Never got over that.
And his autobiography. Okay, he was already dead then.
Yeah.
Now, what about the other guys? I mean, like, there was Carl, the brother.
Yeah.
Okay, he's fine. And there was Mike Love, and there was also Al Jardine. Now, Mike Love comes across in the movie as a curmudgeonly old so-and-so, trying to pretend he did this, that, and the other, trying to say, let's go back to the beach and surf music and stop all this symphonic music, because we're going to lose fans. And that, I would get the impression that Mike Love and a lot of people who follow the Beach Boys say, was a pain in the neck.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Mike didn't like Dennis and didn't want Dennis around. So he was, you know, it was only because of Brian and Carl that Dennis actually got to be in the band. I only met the rest of the band a few times when they did a reunion in Hawaii and a couple of other gigs.
Yeah.
And I never warmed to Mike Love at all. He was a showman. He always had the young girl on his, you know, it was all about, you know, the fame and the glory of it all. I really didn't think he cared, you know, about Brian or about the other stuff. From what I gather from talking to Brian is Brian wanted to just play music. He had all this stuff in his head and he just wanted to create. He hated going out in public. He hated, you know, flying. He didn't like being on stage. It was overwhelming. I think he was too fragile as a human being because of his father that it frightened him. And so all the stuff that he wrote about it because Dennis told him all. He would come back and say, this is what they're doing. This is what everybody's doing, and, you know, the surfing and the whole thing. And so he lived through him in a way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, the only surfer in the band was Dennis.
Yeah.
I mean, Brian certainly wasn't a surfer.
But Brian was afraid of water until Eugene got him swimming. Really? Brian never went into the water, really.
Really?
He didn't like swimming, in being in water.
Yeah, okay, so, like, just getting back then, when you mentioned the father then, there's one scene in the movie where the father, it just shows the father hitting him as a kid, as a small kid, and the kind of the camera goes through the brain and right through as though this could be the start of a psychosis thing. There's also a scene in the movie where he takes LSD and it maybe didn't treat him too well and so could all of that have been, can you look back on all that, or is that just speculation in the movie?
No, I think, well, but I know that he whacked Brian a few times over the head, across the head. I heard that, you know, he hit him one time with the bat, but that's possibly why he was deaf in one ear.
Yeah.
You know, so he was, that's probably why he was deaf, was because he was hit so many times in the ear.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But yes, he was, I'd say it was a combination of stuff. I mean, when you grow up in that kind of psychological and physical abuse, you'd have to find ways of escaping. Do you know? And his father wanted to, you know, be successful. And so, you know.
Yeah, his father, like, and they got on their first deal. He sold all the music then later on when the band didn't even know about it. And he was not a good man on any level. Do you think in any way at all that without realising it, or maybe realising it, that Brian simply replaced, when his father died, his father with Eugene Landy?
I don't know, actually.
Is that a bit too Freudian?
It's a bit deep, Dave, for me.
Yeah, right,
well, I don't know. I never thought of it, I suppose. But I actually, I don't know the sequence of events. I don't know who hired Eugene.
Right.
I don't know if Brian himself hired Eugene or who did.
And by the way, you're no Beach Boys expert or something like that. You wouldn't know all their albums or all their...
No, well, I remember when I got offered the job, I was in Florida.
And Brian who?
I went to a record shop and actually looked at the back of the album cover to see which one was Brian. So that when I walked in, I knew who I was going to meet.
Yeah, right. Well, that's fair enough. By the way, as I say, you got mentioned in the book, also you get a credit on Brian's first solo album.
First solo album,
What does the credit say? Chef, fabulous food, Deirdre.
I don't know. It was just a thank you. Yeah. I think it's just a thank you for, you know. But actually, what's funny about it, Eugene and his wife at the time, I don't know if they were together all the time, but they used to do the same thing I would do, where we'd rhyme words and I'd give him ideas of words to put in the song, you know, when he's trying to formulate things. But they got credit for the writing, the lyrics. I never got credit.
Oh, really?
The
Beach Boys have a strange past, because Dennis has credits with Charles Manson. In the late 60s and that, which is very bizarre stuff. There's a few songs written by, like, you know, Manson, Wilson kind of thing. Some very strange stuff. But the sandbox story, one of the most famous stories of all, is that he's just sitting in a sandbox all day long, which this is just before you came. Was there a sandbox in the place at the back of the house?
No. But we lived on the beach.
Right.
So the back garden was the sand. You know, you'd go, you were right on Malibu Beach. So when you go down the steps out the back garden, out the patio, you're on the beach. But no, there was no, he had no sand thing
then. I've interviewed Brian a couple of times, and, like, you know, it's not that easy necessarily. And there was one time I interviewed him and I said, you know, Paul McCartney has said that if it wasn't for Good Vibrations, that he wouldn't have made Sgt. Pepper's. And, you know, I said, listen, look, 4 years ago, Brian, at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, when you met Paul McCartney, and, like, did he come up to you and say, thank you, Brian? And he said, oh, thank you, sir. And he put the phone down. He reacted to my three words, thank you, Brian, because he thought it was the end of the interview. We were 5 minutes into the interview. Yeah. I was just thinking, okay, now you're going, yes. Yeah. So tell me then, like you would have you want to mother the guy in some ways, in terms of, like, you know, he's just a child in a man's body, is the way you
Well, I remember when the first gig they were going to do together, reunion, was in Hawaii. I think it was their 35 years or something, and there was a big gig.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it was the
You show me all those photographs, I've seen them, yeah.
So it was one of the first times that he was actually now going to be playing with them again, and it was live in Waikiki. I was placed below Brian in the audience, because I got on well with Brian. So the idea was I was to be dancing and Brian would drift off. See, he just play and his head goes down and he drifts off. But you have to keep him engaged so that he looks at the audience. So I had people there so nobody could be in front of me, and I spent the whole time dancing and keeping Brian up.
Brian, so, here I am.
Yeah, but
Brian.
He went through the motions.
Yeah.
And when you, I mean, I met him when he was here 1 year, and I had a whole conversation about Belinda, about the kids.
I remember, I was with you, it was backstage at the Point.
And then I came away and I said to Ursula, my sister, I just went, he didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
He had that whole conversation, he answered the questions, and then I realised he was going through the motions.
Yeah.
So he's very disconnected.
Yeah.
He's very disconnected. And having said that, he's doing great gigs.
Yeah, and he's also, he's back big time now. And like, I mean, in many ways. But like, in his disconnection, though, it'd be easy enough to say that from 1990 to now, in other words, that's 25 years, it's probably been the best 25 years of his life.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things I'd say, it's, I mean, he's got these kids now and, you know, I think he's very happy. I get the impression. I hope so.
He's a bunch of adopted kids.
He's five, I think.
Five adopted kids, yeah.
And when I, the last time I met him, he'd just got the two little girls.
Yeah.
But he always used to say to me that he was never a good father to his girls. He wasn't there for them. That I think that was a huge regret for him when he got himself together and his girls were grown up, that he was never there for them when they were small. So it's nice that he has this, he's been given the opportunity to be a dad and to be there for them.
And the end of the movie is lovely. It just gives a few little paragraphs as to what it all is and how he really is, and the fact that Landy is well out of his life, obviously, and just how everything is going so well now. And then it plays the Love and Mercy song live in concert. Just one last thing I want to ask is this, and that is that like, Melinda comes out of the movie very well, and, you know, she, there's an interview with, in fact, just from a few weeks ago online at the moment, which is interesting, the two of them sitting beside each other, and he's just said, like, she saved my life, etc. Mm. And like, they didn't get married till 95, but she was there for all the Landy years. Did you know her, by the way?
What happened was, and the movie, you know, obviously the time frame, it's all poetic, you know, the way they do movies. But when he bought his Cadillac, he asked her out on a date.
Yeah.
And she went out on a few dates, so she was around. I remember they came over on the boat. I remember a bunch of stuff like that. But then she disappeared.
Because Landy got rid of her.
That's what I realised later was that it wasn't that they weren't getting on. It was obviously she wasn't going to comply with what Eugene wanted.
And that's certainly the implication in the movie.
Yeah. And I do know that there was another person working before I came that was, she wasn't a chef, but she did some other job around the place. And she ended up having some sort of relationship with Brian. And she was to talk about their sexual life back to Eugene.
Right.
So that part is true, and she did do that for a while.
Right.
So this was a, you know, that's why Brian lost trust with people that were around him as well, because they were never sure who was actually saying what. And not that he thought about it that deeply, but he obviously did to a certain point. But I think she just wasn't going to go there. So she was gone for a long time. It was after I left and Eugene, the whole court case and the whole thing, that I heard they were back together again. But I liked her. I thought she was a nice person.
Well, she's still there with him. By the way, just at the beginning, he hands her a card when he's buying the car. And it just says three things on it: frightened, scared, lonely. She has no idea who he is until so. That, by the way, that's Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys. And would you have? There was never a time in the house when there was nobody else there but you and him. You said, "Listen, get me out of here."
No,
and I'm a celebrity.
And actually, when I saw that note, now I can't say I know everything about because I wasn't with him all the time.
Yeah.
But I actually found that a little bit unbelievable that Brian would have written that and given her that. That was just one part that actually I thought I can't imagine Brian doing that.
Okay, why did you leave, or did you have enough?
You know, when you work for somebody like that, you work for any famous people, you know, really at the end of the day, they own you in a sense, because there's no 9 to 5, you know, your holidays are all based around those things. And I wanted to pursue, I actually went on to study Chinese medicine and I wanted to change from being a chef and do nutrition and do other things. So it's, you know, and it just got to, I wanted to have my own holiday and not be going on holiday with Eugene and Brian and be doing all the cooking and entertaining everybody. It wasn't really a holiday, even though it was Hawaii, but, you know, sorry. And Eugene got to the point where the more, less control he had of me, the less he wanted me around. Because at the end of the day, it was nice at first, but really he needed people around that he could control. Yeah. And the more I distanced myself and had my, I got my own apartment and moved out of the living, then he suddenly had less control over me because I wasn't living in the situation.
Yeah.
And I think it was a natural, you know, he was ready to let me go as well.
Well, in terms of the golden age of rock and roll, he's one of the most fascinating kind of periphery characters, non-musician. Everybody knows Dr. Eugene Landy. So listen, look, Deirdre, thank you so much. Just, what are you doing now?
Well, I am doing the Chinese medicine. I do herbal medicine, acupuncture, and nutrition, which is what I've always wanted to do. But I also do a lot of lecturing and teaching the subject and teaching
and that takes
other
you
practitioners.
To everything from Scandinavia to California.
To California. Yeah.
Right. And when is the book coming out?
The book soon.
Soon. And what's the book about?
Brian Wilson.
No, it's not.
No, I'm doing a book on health and nutrition, but based on the Chinese principles of that we all are very individual and we all shouldn't be doing the same thing and we shouldn't all be on the same diet or eating this. We shouldn't all be vegetarians and we have to find out what it is that works for us and makes us happy.
Well, we will look out for that. Dr. Deirdre Courtney, my sister-in-law. Thanks a million, Deirdre.
Thanks, Dave.
Mornings with Dave Fanning on RTE Radio 1.